Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my pleasure to have organized this event for Professor Banai to come and speak about the Korematsu case, very famous. But the man who suggested this great idea, Michael Lee, I'm going to let introduce Professor Banai. So Michael Lee, attorney here in town.
Thanks, George. I am honored to introduce Professor Lorraine Banai, author of the recently published book, Fred Korematsu and His Quest for Justice. And so timely a book as we confront a national election in which attacks on unpopular religious and ethnic minorities are being utilized as a potent political tool. This is a meticulously researched, scholarly, but profoundly human account of an ordinary man who possessed extraordinary courage to say no to the entire American government with enduring conviction and to become a genuine American civil rights icon and hero for all time. Professor Banai was perfectly positioned to produce this book with her personal background as an accomplished litigator, a respected legal scholar, and an admired civil rights activist whose own exemplary family was not immune from the injustices of internment. Professor Banai's mother was just 16 years old when she and her family were sent to Manzanar in the Mojave Desert. But despite that travesty, Hideko Banai went on to earn a PhD, to teach at the USC School of Education, and to serve as a governor on the board of the California Community Colleges system. And after Professor Banai's father and his family were sent to Manzanar also, Paul Banai enlisted in the U.S. Army and served in the military intelligence service in the South Pacific with distinction, eventually becoming the first Japanese-American elected to the California legislature and later appointed to head the Department of Memorial Affairs of the Veterans Administration, appointed by President Ronald Reagan. And as we ponder how to respond to this new wave of xenophobic attacks in America, Professor Banai's book is also an account of how Professor Peter Irons and a team of immensely passionate, inspired, and talented, mostly third-generation Japanese-Americans attorneys, including Professor Banai, worked intensely, brilliantly, and collaboratively to reverse Fred Korematsu's criminal conviction and to thereby psychologically and legally liberate two generations of their parents and grandparents who, just because of their familial origins in Japan, were forced to bear the shame, the stigma, and the trauma of mass relocation and incarceration by their own country. So please join me in warmly welcoming Professor Lorraine Banai.
Thank you so much, Mike. I really, really appreciate that. George, and the Commonwealth Club for making this event possible, and to all of you tonight for being here. Before I begin, I want to acknowledge the presence of Karen Korematsu, Fred Korematsu's daughter. Karen, through her Fred T. Korematsu Institute here in San Francisco, has traveled the country speaking nationally on civil rights issues, particularly focusing on K-12 education and encouraging civic engagement on issues to advance civil rights. And so I really appreciate the fact that you're here this evening. I'm so grateful to be able to talk about Fred here in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's where I got my law degree. It's where I started my legal career. It's where I still have so many good friends, many of whom are here tonight. But most importantly, this is where Fred's story took place. It's where he grew up in Oakland. It's where in 1942 he challenged the wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans, and where 40 years later I had the privilege of working with the remarkable legal team that Mike just mentioned to help Fred successfully reopen his case to gain some measure of justice for himself as well as the rest of the Japanese American community. Some of you here knew him. Many of you here were perhaps just touched by him. This was really very much his community where he went out, and it really became his home, where he spoke out at different events, where he showed up at different events, where he even licked envelopes to advance other people's causes. And so there's something very welcoming and something very comfortable about coming back here in the community that was his home. There were a number of reasons why I decided to write this book. And of course, first and foremost, it was so that other people would know him. He was a very good and a very principled man, as well as the story behind his case, which we all know is one of the darkest moments in Supreme Court history. In December 1941, Fred was a 22-year-old welder living on his family's flower nursery here in Oakland. And with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, fear gripped the country. In the days following, community leaders, Buddhist priests, Shinto priests, Japanese language teachers, newspaper editors, and others were rounded up and taken away from their families. In the months following, the public, the popular press, civic organizations, and public officials at every single level of government, including the entire West Coast congressional delegation, called for the mass removal of the entire Japanese-American population from the West Coast on the ground of fear of espionage and sabotage. On February 19, 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, under which authority the commander of the Western Defense, John L. DeWitt, Lieutenant General John L. DeWitt, began to issue a series of orders, culminating in the incarceration of over 110,000 persons of Japanese ancestry. They included babes in arms on up. Two-thirds were like my parents and Fred, American citizens. They were sent to camps in the most desolate, forbidding places of the interior United States, surrounded by barbed wire and armed guard. Fred chose instead to stay. He chose to remain with the white woman that he loved in the place that had always been his home. He was arrested. While in jail, he was visited by Ernest Besick, director of the Northern California ACLU, who asked Fred if he was willing to bring a test case to challenge his conviction or challenge the constitutionality of his arrest, and Fred readily agreed. The fight, however, would not be easy. Besig and the local ACLU chapter met with resistance from the national ACLU over its handling of Fred's case. The national office said that the military orders could be challenged, but not on any basis that questioned FDR. For example, while counsel representing Fred could argue that DeWitt was motivated by racism in implementing Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, counsel could not argue that Roosevelt himself had exceeded his war power. But Besig and Fred's counsel, Wayne Collins, insisted that they were bound to make every argument that they could on Fred's behalf and refused to be constrained by national. Further, when Fred was sent to camp to be imprisoned with the rest of the Japanese-American community, his family felt shamed by his arrest, and other Japanese-Americans shunned him as a criminal. The National Japanese American Citizens League, which had urged compliance with the incarceration as a sign of loyalty, condemned those like Fred who sought to resist as so-called self-styled martyrs. Despite being outcast by his decision to resist, Fred knew the incarceration was wrong. Although convicted at trial, Fred felt for sure he'd prevail when his case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. However, in 1944, the court, in one of its most widely condemned decisions, upheld his conviction. Some of you who are lawyers here may remember reading Korematsu versus United States in law school. I do. In strained reasoning, the court upheld the constitutionality of the orders removing Japanese Americans from the West Coast on the ground that the civil authorities and military officials could have reasonably believed that Japanese Americans as a people posed a threat to the country. To support its reasoning, neither the government nor the court could point to any evidence that Fred or any other member of the Japanese American community had committed or threatened to commit any act of espionage or sabotage. There was no evidence. Instead, the court's reasoning in Fred's case and the earlier Hirabayashi case that upheld a curfew against Japanese Americans looked to certain questionable, highly questionable assumptions and unfounded claims and stereotypes with regard to Japanese Americans and their culture, practices, and beliefs. For example, the court noted that Japanese Americans' children attended Japanese language school, believed to be the source of Japanese nationalistic propaganda, and Japanese Americans had dual citizenship. The court said that these and other, quote, data reasonably supported the conclusion that Japanese Americans had close ties to Japan. In the end, the court concluded that Fred Korematsu was not removed from the West Coast by any hostility to him or his race. Instead, the court explained he was excluded because we were at war with Japan and military authorities made a rational decision that this move was necessary to protect the country. Fred said that on learning of the court's decision, he felt he lost his country. For 40 years, Fred lived with his conviction, but hoped that one day, someday, there might be a chance to be able to reopen his case. An opportunity arose in 1982, as mentioned earlier. He received a call from legal historian Peter Irons, who had found shocking documents during his research. Those documents, along with others found by archival researcher Aiko Yoshinaga Herzig, established that the government had suppressed, altered, and destroyed material evidence bearing on the issue of military necessity while it was arguing Fred's case before the Supreme Court. For example, the government had within its possession intelligence reports from the FBI, the FCC, and the Office of Naval Intelligence, refuting the necessity of mass incarceration, and the government's attorneys failed to disclose these documents to the court. The FBI and the FCC said there was no basis for Lieutenant General DeWitt's claims that Japanese Americans had been involved in illegal shore-to-ship signaling. Kenneth Ringel of the Office of Naval Intelligence said that thorough intelligence had been conducted of the within the Japanese American community, that any issue could be dealt with on an individual basis, and advising strongly against any mass incarceration. Justice Department lawyer Edward Ennis urged his superiors to tell the court of these reports, saying that any other course of action would amount to suppression of evidence. Justice Department lawyer John L. Burling tried to insert a footnote in the government's brief. Okay. Thank you. So have a really nice picture of the microphone in my face there. Tried to insert a footnote in the government's brief in Fred's case to advise the court that the department had information that contradicted DeWitt's report, but the footnote was ordered revised, so the court never learned that there was contrary evidence. Further, when it was discovered that DeWitt's final report, which explained the basis for the mass incarceration, contradicted the government's arguments before the Supreme Court, his report was ordered revised. DeWitt had originally said that lack of time was not the basis for the orders. Instead, he explained the reality was that one could never separate the sheep from the goats within the Japanese American community, no matter how much time one had. In Fred's case, however, the government had consistently argued that the mass removal was necessary because there was not sufficient time to separate the loyal from those believed to be disloyal. When it was discovered that DeWitt's report contradicted the government's argument, the report was ordered revised to align better with the government's argument. The original versions of the report were ordered destroyed. One copy of the original report survived, And the soldier who destroyed the reports did not destroy his memo saying he destroyed the reports. Truth is stranger than fiction, right? When Peter presented Fred with a sampling of these documents, Fred read them silently. And then, after what seemed to Peter to be an eternity, Fred looked up and said simply, "They did me a great wrong." He agreed to reopen his case. In 1983, in the Federal District Court Clerk's office just down the road, a legal team filed a petition for writ of error coram nobis on Fred's behalf. We had to madly do research on what the heck a writ of error coram nobis was. Coram nobis being a little used procedure for challenging a conviction after sentence has been served to rectify a manifest injustice. I was privileged to serve on that legal team and work with the most talented and passionate lawyers. Dale Minami, Don Tamaki, Bob Rusky, Karen Kai, the Honorable Ed Chen, the Honorable Dennis Hayashi, Margie Barrows, Leon Miyasato, and Eric Yamamoto, now both of Honolulu, many of whom still remain outstanding members of this legal community. I was also privileged to work with the most wonderful and equally passionate client, Fred. He knew that his case did not belong to him. The entire Japanese American community had been wronged. He also knew that the case had even broader meaning, that it was about the need to protect civil liberties even during or perhaps especially during times of crisis. On November 10th, 1983, in the ceremonial courtroom of the federal building packed with Japanese Americans who had survived the camps, Judge Marilyn Hall Patel vacated Fred's conviction, finding that the government had lied in seeking to justify its actions before the Supreme Court. Winning his case, though, was really just a beginning for Fred, not an end. He went on to speak across the country, to colleges and universities, especially to law schools, before grade schools and high schools, civil liberties organizations, civic groups, and professional organizations to tell people what had happened to him and the Japanese American community so that hopefully what happened to them would not happen again. His wartime case became only more relevant as the country turned on Muslims, persons of Middle Eastern descent, and those believed to look like them. Fred wrote op-ed pieces to speak out against the targeting of marginalized communities. He signed on to amicus briefs, reminding that the country during World War II had sacrificed civil liberties in the name of national security and came to regret it. In recognition of his wartime stance and later activism, President Bill Clinton awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1988, stating that in the long history of our country's constant search for justice, some names of ordinary people stand for millions of souls. Plessy, Brown, Parks. To that distinguished list today, we add the name Fred Korematsu. So writing this book was the opportunity to share Fred's message, that his case and the wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans were rooted in the same brand of stereotype, hysteria, and fear that has fueled the targeting of other communities throughout history and that continues today. Before Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans were viewed as untrustworthy and treacherous, perceived to be a threat to American jobs and the American way of life. Newspaper headlines called Japanese immigrants a scourge on society. Crime and poverty go hand in hand with Asiatic labor. Japanese a menace to American women. And the yellow peril, how Japanese crowd out the white race. Japanese immigrants were denied the ability to become naturalized citizens or own the land that they farmed. Japanese Americans were prohibited from marrying whites. In 1924, the exclusionists won their campaign to stop all further immigration from Japan. That rhetoric and de jure and de facto exclusion that provided the groundwork for the wartime mass incarceration are frighteningly similar to the type of rhetoric and exclusion that we've seen over the years in connection with the targeting of other vulnerable communities during times of crisis. For example, in 1988, during the AIDS epidemic, when there was talk of quarantining persons living with AIDS. An article, AIDS and Mr. Korematsu, cautioned that the wartime incarceration demonstrated that government power ought to be exercised with extreme caution, especially when exercised over disadvantaged and heavily stigmatized minorities. During the Gulf War, Fred's case was again raised as a caution. An essay remembering Korematsu stated, "The Arabs are the Japanese of 1991. Never mind that Arab Americans are American citizens and that they're more likely to be victims than the perpetrators of racial violence." Fred wrote, "There are Arab Americans today who are going through what Japanese Americans experienced years ago, and we can't let that happen." And today we see ignorance and fear combine to harm vulnerable communities as Muslims and those perceived to look like them are cast as terrorists and maligned based on their beliefs and dress, as persons of Mexican ancestry are branded as illegals and criminals, as blacks continue to be subject to stereotype that treats them as lesser and dangerous, both as the result of overt, intentional discrimination, but often in deeply rooted and unconscious, but just as pernicious ways. The list can go on. In each example, we see ignorance and fear combine to harm communities less able to protect themselves. Ignorance about a people, about who they are and their intrinsic humanity, and fear born of stereotype depicting these communities as somehow threatening. As was mentioned earlier, this Commonwealth Club series is about big solutions for big problems. I wish I had some big solution for the intractable and growing chasm in race relations and bigotry against historically marginalized communities that's only become louder. I claim no expertise here. The most I can do is offer a few of my own thoughts as well as share my own post-it notes to myself. People sometimes ask, can't we just change the law, make it illegal to discriminate, ensure that the law equally protects everyone, regardless of race, color, or creed? Why not just overrule Korematsu? Changes in the law to protect vulnerable communities can only help, of course. And explicitly overruling horrible precedent like Korematsu would have tremendous meaning. But none of them alone would provide an answer. We had a constitution that guaranteed equal protection back then, and it didn't protect Japanese Americans during World War II. I can see no big solution except for one that calls on each of us to figure out for ourselves what we can do individually and proactively to help address the national problem of intolerance and fear against minority communities. I know many of you are already doing so much. You're already pathbreakers in speaking out against injustice or providing your time and support to others seeking change, whether political candidates or advocacy organizations, helping those among us who deserve more and better, whether by serving as a mentor, providing pro bono legal representation, or working in a soup kitchen. You're all my heroes. And at this time, when it seems the racial divide in our country is only becoming worse, when racial hostility has become empowered in ways we haven't seen in decades, we can each ask ourselves if we can do more. Relevant to tonight, I hope you'll tell others about Fred and the Japanese American incarceration, that we can't go down that path again. In the last year, despite conclusive evidence and official recognition to the contrary, we've seen the wartime incarceration held up as positive precedent for singling out other groups and ignorance about what really happened during World War II. Last November, the mayor of Roanoke, Virginia, asked his agencies to refuse to provide assistance to Syrian refugees, citing the World War II incarceration as precedent. Donald Trump has compared his call to ban immigration of Muslims to FDR's orders that authorized the wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans, and one poll found that a third of his supporters believe the incarceration was a good idea. In prior years, there have been a few individuals and conservative think tanks who have gone so far as to publicly state that they thought the incarceration was right. But in the last year, we've seen a swath of the public take that view, empowered and given voice. We can each ask ourselves if we can say more to say that's not who we are. Fred did that. He spoke up. He didn't have to. He was soft-spoken and so averse to the public limelight that when he agreed to reopen his case in 1981, the only thing he asked of us was whether he could avoid speaking in public and having the press camped out on his front lawn. But when he saw how hard his legal team worked, how much they were going out to speak about his case, how Japanese Americans, mothers and fathers, and other community members were making donations of $10, $20, $50 to support his case because it was so important to them, and how what happened to Japanese Americans could happen to other people, he knew he had to speak. And before he knew it, he was speaking before a standing room only crowd at the San Francisco Press Club, and Ed Bradley and his 60 Minutes crew were camped out on his front lawn. Speaking out against injustice is certainly one thing we can do. But there's other less obvious things we can do, and some are much harder. We can ask ourselves the extent to which we are and refuse to be part of the problem. A few things I hope we can continue to ask ourselves. First, am I in any way complicit through my silence? During World War II, there were those who actively advocated for the incarceration. There were some brave individuals who spoke out against it, but there were also those who said nothing and let it happen. The major civil liberties organizations failed to oppose the mass incarceration before it took place, and we can ask ourselves if we're allowing injustice by failing to challenge it. Second, we can ask ourselves what we may be failing to see. Our positions of privilege, economic, social, racial, positional, can give us, unfortunately, a fairly narrow lens. When we seek those things that preserve what we have and that we believe will protect us, we might ask if there are attendant costs to others. During World War II, the country sought security through the banishment of an entire community, and we now know that that was wrong. Finally, when I look at someone passing on the street or sitting on a bench, do I see their humanity? Too often, individuals and groups are prejudged based simply on how they look, like Japanese Americans were prejudged as foreign and treacherous during World War II. Study after study tells us that we all possess automatic responses to race and other forms of difference, even the most progressive among us. I don't think we can hope to make any progress towards a just and more equal society if we do not do more to understand how racial and other forms of discrimination operate. Not just the overt forms of bigoted racists, but also unconsciously and institutionally affected by well-meaning individuals who would never see themselves as racist. We can question systems that perpetuate the disadvantages experienced by communities of color in effect, even if not by design. Many who played roles in the World War II incarceration believed that they acted in the best interests of this country, but came to later regret their actions and inaction. Earl Warren, later celebrated as a champion of civil rights during his tenure on the Supreme Court, was a vocal advocate for the removal of Japanese Americans when he was Attorney General of California during World War II. He later expressed his remorse. It was wrong to react so impulsively without positive evidence of disloyalty, even though we felt we had good motive in the security of our state. It demonstrates the cruelty of war when fear, get tough, military psychology, propaganda, and racial antagonism combine with one's responsibility for public security to produce such acts. Fred Korematsu was not highly educated. He had little money. He was a welder and then a draftsman, and he sometimes worked two jobs to support his family. He was not an articulate speaker. When we heard him talk about his wartime case, we often followed him down side streets before returning to the topic at hand, but that was part of what made us love him. Despite his lack of education, money, or position, he changed hearts and minds, and that tells me that we can each be change agents, even if in some small way. Thank you very much for being here this evening, and I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts and questions.
So
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Professor Lorraine Banai from the University of Seattle University Law School, speaking about her book on the Korematsu case. Who would like to ask the first question?
The redress turned out to be $20,000 per living person. It's a low valuation for the effect that it made for decades on one's life. How do we evaluate that factor into the settlement?
How do we evaluate which factor into the...
That it, to us today, from a modern viewpoint, it seems like a low valuation mm-hmm. for the effect on many decades of life. So how do we evaluate that? How was that sum decided?
Mm-hmm. Well, I obviously it bore no relationship to any reality as far as what was suffered. What do you do with 3 years of life and loss of liberty for 3 years, loss of community, loss of family, all of that. So I think anyone would say it's token reparations and kind of on the theory that we are, hopefully it will help the country remember, and our system of laws is a system in which we provide compensation, or we try and provide compensation. I stop because I think it all happened so we wouldn't forget. And now today, I think there's a real concern about whether we learned. I have to say, I think there's been a lot of progress. I mean, a lot more people now know about the incarceration than they did before. During some of these episodes, people come right back and say, well, you totally don't understand what happened to Japanese Americans. There's a lot more awareness of it. But I wish that when redress happened, and the payment was made, and all the politicians said, "This is so we won't forget." People actually didn't forget. But anyway, I will say also, though, that for many people, that $20,000 really was really helped. Right? If you really didn't have that much, so it was very helpful.
I have two related questions. The first is, you alluded to the JACL not necessarily supporting a protest of the internment. I wonder if you could elaborate on that, both during the World War II time period and since then. There's been internal tension among Japanese Americans, those who were in the 442nd who fought and the draft resistors, a sort of tension between those who were very assimilated and who didn't want to make waves and those who wanted to protest. The second question related to that is, I wonder if you could add a little bit more background. You mentioned that Fred Korematsu, many years later, decades later, said the government had done him a great wrong. There was about a 25, maybe 30-year time period, though, from the end of World War II, from VJ Day, until the time that activists such as yourself reopened these cases, when collectively Japanese Americans didn't want to talk about this, sort of had a very interesting adaptive strategy of moving on. I wonder if you might just comment on it, both mm-hmm. as to Fred and as to others.
Mm-hmm. So first of all, with regard to the resistors, I mean, what happened, one of the things I really wanted to do in writing the book was to really examine the diversity of responses to the incarceration. I think that the popular narrative always been that Japanese Americans kind of went to camp and complied and all of that, and as a show of loyalty. Now, it is true that that's a popular narrative because the National Japanese American Citizens League took that approach and said, we can best respond by complying to show our loyalty. And if we don't respond, we'll lose any possibility of being respected as good American citizens. And so kind of the mainline approach was, let's go, let's comply. But I think behind that, a lot of Japanese Americans complied to show their loyalty, but a lot of Japanese Americans complied because there was not a culture of protest at that time, right? What are you going to do? The government's got bayonets. The soldiers have bayonets. We have to go. The thing I'm going to think about is, how do I get out of here? How do I take care of my family? And so I think the responses to the Japanese American incarceration were numerous. Fear, anger, hurt, betrayal, and not just compliance. But the Japanese American Citizens League really, really urged compliance. That was the quote party line. And in that vein, there were resistors. There were people like Fred Korematsu, Min Yasui, Gordon Hirabayashi. There were individuals who resisted being drafted out of camp, because they were being held in camp and, you know, I'll serve my country as long as you, let my family free. So there were resistors. And so there was, I think, a real tension that started during the war between the people who resisted, who were viewed as not complying, viewed as criminals and all, and the main JACL view of compliance. And that's persisted until today. I mean, I think there's still been healing going on within the Japanese American community. I think there's been a lot of healing that's gone on around that, and that's really great. With regard to the second thing, I think when Japanese Americans left camp, it certainly was, again, I think there were a lot of different reactions. It's not a homogeneous community. But I think for a lot of Japanese Americans, it was just leaving the camp and rebuilding. They needed to just rebuild. A lot of them just wanted to forget about it. They wanted to try and put their lost communities back together again. For my parents, they never talked about it. I think for a lot of Japanese American parents, they didn't really talk about it very much. We would hear about camp. Oh, yes, you know, Mr. Matsumoto, I knew him in camp, or such and such. And from my framework, the only thing I knew was Girl Scout camp. Right? There was no talk about camp being like this really horrible, dark period of time for them. I think they really wanted to move on. Now I think different families responded differently. But of course, you know, Fred didn't tell Karen, he didn't tell his own children about his case and his conviction until Karen was in high school. It was the first time she heard about it. I learned about the camps mainly from Asian American Studies classes that I took at UC Santa Barbara. You know, so, but my mother told me a story about how when she left camp, they had like this disorientation session about, now, remember when you leave camp, don't stand around in groups of other Japanese, don't speak Japanese, make yourself kind of like blend in, don't draw attention to yourself. And when I brought the case, when I was part of the legal team that reopened the case, the first thing she said was she was really worried about me, you know, what's the government going to do to me? So there's got to be a tremendous psychological scar for having gone through this experience for the Nisei. And so that they didn't talk about it, I think, is totally understandable.
Thank you. I'm Glenn Fukushima. Thank you very much for your talk. I have two questions. The first is, in writing the book, did you learn anything new? What did you learn? What was the experience of writing the book, number one? Number two, as a legal matter, are these cases closed? In fact, I mean, given the change in the political assessment of those cases, and given the fact that the Supreme Court may, within the next couple of years, turn in a more progressive direction, is there something that is possible legally to do to make absolutely clear that these cases can be overturned, and so that there will not be a precedent that some people would use to try to justify future interments?
Mm-hmm. So as far as something surprising, it was a really interesting process, right? Because I knew Fred, worked with Fred, I knew the family, so I kind of like knew the story. But it was really, really wonderful getting into the research. So one thing that always comes to mind for me is being at the California Historical Society, just over here on Mission, and looking at Fred's wartime, Ernest Bessig's wartime papers with the ACLU, and finding this file of correspondence between Fred and Bessig, and letters they wrote to each other, and the great affection that the two men came to have for each other. Fred would write to Bessig about how's your Victory Garden growing, and Bessig would write to him about the fog in San Francisco, and it was really just lovely. And I just kind of like page after page reading these letters between the two men, it gives you a much more human sense. And what a lovely, lovely relationship they had, and what a lovely man. Fred was gracious and grateful. So that was really probably particularly special experience going and I remember contacting Karen and saying, oh my gosh, I just looked at your grandmother's immigration file and found the photos, formal photos of her grandmother and grandfather and the Angel Island interview. So things like that. As far as, what was the second part of it?
The really close the legal matter.
Right.
To actually make sure that
This is a conversation that I had with Dale the other night, which is that I think the Korematsu case has several slices, and it really depends on what slice you're talking about. So this is kind of like legal stuff, is that when the court decides a case, they're deciding a number of different things, not just one thing. So as far as what Korematsu says about can you discriminate? Can you take a whole bunch of people and throw them into camp? I think a lot of people would say that could be hard to do now, particularly American citizens. If you take another slice of it, though, which is basically that the president has a wide range of power during war, the government's not giving up that power lightly. And I don't know if the court will give up that power lightly, right? And we actually see that being played out in the courts now, is that the power to wage war is plenary and courts are silent during times of war. The good thing is that some courts now are saying it is our job to review what the government's doing, even if they're doing it under what they claim is a war power, that the courts still have a role in making sure that the government's not exceeding its authority. And we've seen some very brave judges in the Hedges case that came in a little while ago who said it is our job to make sure that the Constitution is complied with. So I suppose that's a kind of complicated way of answering your question, saying, I think if you just overruled Korematsu, the question for me would be, well, what part just got overruled, right? So, that's the best that I can do on that one, I think.
So I had the privilege of actually knowing Ernie Bessig, and he also was a pretty soft-spoken guy. And I was sort of intrigued by your comments about Ernie actually reaching out to Fred to pursue the litigation. And I know that it was probably the most important thing that Ernie ever did in his life. But I was sort of wondering how that whole process got started from a historian's point of view as opposed to what Ernie would say, because he was very mm-hmm. soft-spoken and very, never wanted to have the spotlight.
No, he didn't. Actually, it's so sad. There's so little written about him, and I think it really is because he didn't want the limelight, right? He doesn't have a biography. He doesn't have all these things about him. So the way that I understand it from my research is that basically National ACLU was looking for a test case, wrote to the West Coast chapters looking for a test case. Bessig went out looking for a test case. He went to, whenever he read in the paper that some Japanese American had been arrested, he would go and ask them if they'd be the test case, and they'd say no. And so actually the day that he went to where Fred was, there were two or three other Japanese Americans who were arrested, and they both said no, and Fred said yes. And so that was the beginning of it. And then Bessig went out and got Wayne Collins to actually represent Fred, and then National came in with this, like, well, yes, you can represent him, but you can't do X.
And that's why the National Civil Liberties, Northern California has always been sort of apart from National.
Yeah, I don't know about now, but it's a very interesting. It was a very interesting chapter in the Northern, a piece in the chapter of Northern California.
Next question. I have a question about this reticence of people to go in, and a lot of people after the fact kind of think about it and say, why didn't they do more? But it's across the board. You know, my father was reticent about talking about his experiences in World War II when he was a soldier. I think everybody is reticent about the worst parts of their life. And if you ask why, you know, for children who were abused as children, and then they say, you didn't say anything until you were 40 years old, well, they also don't want to talk about it. I mean, people don't want to talk about the worst parts of their life or the things that are embarrassing. So I think it'd be interesting for us all to understand that part of the equation a little bit more, too. And I was wondering, from your research, and the question that he asked earlier about how the two communities, the ones who speak out versus the ones who didn't speak out, of course, the ones who speak out take risks, you know, and the other ones don't from a certain point of view, but they take other risks. I think just a little bit more understanding of that would also help, in addition to all the other parts of how we all look at things.
About how some people spoke out,
about
some people...
how everybody can react differently to this experience, and that it doesn't make you a total coward. You know, if you don't say something, you might have three children, the other person doesn't. There's all kinds of reasons that people do this in the worst circumstances. If you went and talked to the Tutsis and the Hutus fairly recently and said, you know, why didn't you do something about this? You know, how could you possibly have done this all in 3 weeks? You know, and you'll find a lot of very normal answers, about why I didn't do it while I was out of town at the time or whatever, you know.
Well, then that's why I pose them as questions. I think that we need to look at them as questions to ask ourselves.
Right.
You know, we can't always do everything whenever anything happens. And so what we have to do is just ask ourselves, you know, this is going on right now. Am I complicit in this by not doing anything? Is this something I can actually do anything about? But I think it's and like I said during the last part of my remarks, some of these are hard things to do, but at least we should ask. And I think during World War II, people did let it happen. And there were surprisingly very, very few people who spoke up against it. And so I suppose what I'm asking is not necessarily that there be like a mass, I mean, it'd be nice if there was a mass uprising against it, but it's shocking how few organizations and individuals spoke up.
Yeah, and the other internments during World War II in Germany, for example, people also didn't speak up and were killed. You know, it wasn't even just a terrible experience. It was a total mass slaughter, and still people cooperated.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing what we'll do in order to avoid embarrassment, in order to stand out or to be brave. It's a very difficult choice, and I think
it's very hard.
That's why I think it's important to kind of understand that part of the equation as well.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone cheers the person on who was brave. Once it works to their advantage, it was many years later, it's a lot easier to say that was a great thing that you did for all of us, you know. But at the time, as you said, at the time when he went to the camp, he was given a hard time by people for having done it. So.
And I suppose that's why it's hard for me to do big solutions. I can do small, what can we do in smaller ways that may help?
Well, I think, it's sort of a little bit like high school, because we just keep living our lives as if we were in high school. But, you know, there are people who will stand out and say something. And a lot of people will not do anything against the administration or whatever, just even to make a comment about anything. But they'll all come up to you and say, I'm really glad you're doing it. I'm really glad you're doing it. And I think, we kind of have to see that that's such a difficult thing. Some people are easily braver than other people for whatever reason it is. And I think it's good to see that the people who are quiet, I don't mean the silent majority of Nixon, but that people who are quiet are also playing a role in support and probably will be the ones who will support you once it has gone the way you want it to go. But I think if we don't understand that, it's a difficult thing to understand how to move things forward because we have to enable those people. Next question. Good.
Hi, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about post-internment and what happened. How Japanese Americans were they able to re-assimilate in the community? How they were able to resurrect lives? Just what happened afterwards?
I think when they came back, a lot were met with hostility. There was a lot of media about we don't want them back. There were some instances of violence and vandalism. There were certainly many who were able to come back, that there were friends and neighbors who watched their property. Fred's family came back and their greenhouses had been broken, windows broken, but the property was still there. They had to rebuild it, though. So it varied. I mean, some people had to come back and live in, you know, communal housing. My family lived in a trailer park for a while. They had to rebuild. They had to put everything back together again, find jobs. For a lot, they had to go to figure out, well, how do I go to college? You know, their educations and their lives had been disrupted. And so they had to figure out how to rebuild again, and they did, you know. There was housing discrimination, there was employment discrimination, but they figured a way to rebuild. And you'll hear all these stories about people who resume going to college, you know, were able to rebuild their lives, have their families, and be successful. But I think there's also stories that we don't hear so much about of people who might have been broken by the experience.
You mentioned earlier about how you didn't find out until you were quite old. Do you think that something was passed on to you anyway by your families? Because it would seem like a lot of people didn't find out, but still a certain amount of fear or a certain amount of distrust or anything like that?
I don't know. I like to think it's strength. I don't know if that's true, but I think a lot of us think about our grandparents and our parents and just their strength. And that had to hopefully have been passed down to us. And their tremendous belief, I mean, they poured so much, I think, into their children and their futures. So I really didn't know about it, but I think a lot of people will say it's impacted the third generation Japanese Americans, even if we didn't grow up knowing about it. Yeah.
I have a question, but before that, I just wanted to quickly try to kind of address your question, which is, I think that the fact that it was Japanese Americans did have an impact on the reaction, in the sense that I think Japanese culture, especially in that period, I think did emphasize the need for conformity, deference to authority, not sticking out. The nail that sticks out gets hammered down. And this notion of shikatakanai, where it's kind of a fatalistic view that you're kind of given conditions from above and you have to submit to that. I think all of those factors did contribute. I wouldn't say that was determinative, but I think, you know, it does. I mean, one could think of, for instance, Jewish Americans experiencing the Holocaust and how many, not all, but many Jewish Americans are very, you know, very, very committed to making that story known. And also to ensuring civil rights and civil liberties because of that experience. I think, you know, the reaction is somewhat different, but part of it is cultural, I think. My question is, as attorneys looking at this case 30 years later or 40 years later, if you had been in 1942, would you have argued this case differently? I mean, were there things that you found that, as lawyers, you felt these people should have argued the case differently? They should have used the facts differently. They should have used the law differently. I mean, were there things that you guys felt that if you had been there, you would have been able to do a better job? How do you assess the lawyers?
Dale, you want to try that?
Would one of the other lawyers like to answer that one?
I think it was they argued the arguments they had to make. Due process violations, equal protection based on due process, a violation of the constitutional rights. What they didn't have was the information that was being suppressed and altered and destroyed. So had they had that information, of course, that was our argument in Coram Nobis cases, that the justices would come to a different conclusion. So because of the fraud that was committed on the Supreme Court, it's essentially the lawyers were handicapped. They didn't know DeWitt's report was going to be funneled through an amicus brief, through a side door into the Supreme Court. They didn't know that the Korematsu case was going to be manipulated to not come up with Hirabayashi, but to be sent down to the Ninth Circuit, brought up a year and a half later so they could manipulate the evidence more. So I think the lawyers did a fine job. Okay. I really do. And I stand by, especially, you know, the courage of a Wayne Collins, who represented so many Japanese Americans and never got, I don't think, the credit he deserved. He was a terrific, terrific lawyer.
Can I add one thing?
This is Donald Tamaki. We were on the team together with Lori.
So just to comment with what Dale said and, of course, what Lori said,
The interesting thing is Fred and his attorney, Wayne Collins, were completely isolated from this back and forth that was going on between Justice Department lawyers, the War Department, the Attorney General, the Navy, the FBI, the Federal Communications Commission. So what Lori's talking about and Peter Irons found with Aiko Yoshinaga Herzig was all these communications going all swirling all around Fred and Wayne Collins, but they were never privy to any of that. So and the argument was simply, look, we've got evidence that contradicts every claim the Army is making. It undermines it. It blows it out of the water completely. We have a duty to disclose it. And then there's this back and forth saying we're not going to do it, and they refuse to do it. So the interesting thing is the lawyers were completely in the dark, except on the except on the government side.
Well, what I learned is from the Coram Nobis team, it was clearly government misconduct. And then I would also like to point out that in my father's Supreme Court case that was decided in 1944, it was not a unanimous decision. It was a 6-3 decision. And the three dissenting opinions are really the studied mostly today. Justice Jackson referred to my father's Supreme Court case as this lies around like a loaded weapon, ready for anyone to pick up with plausible cause and use. And actually, after 9/11, Korematsu versus United States was cited as a possible reason to round up Arab and Muslim Americans and put them again in American concentration camps. One thing I'd also like to point out is that we are trying in education, since that's what I'm focusing on today and carrying on my father's legacy, is to change the euphemisms. We talk about, we use the word internment and, you know, the government used that word, but we use incarceration. And they're referred to even as concentration camps, because that's really what they were, American concentration camps. Additionally to the question about the reparations, really what the Japanese Americans wanted from the redress was the apology. The apology was most important. It's just that if you don't throw money at the government, you just don't get their attention. And also we wanted money for public education. We were able to create a Civil Liberties Public Education Fund. And I think even Dale Menami headed up that portion in the beginning. And actually, through legislation in California, they're trying to also establish that again. Because clearly, as we have heard, you know, the lessons of history have not been heard. The irony to Mr. Besick and the ACLU, because at the time of my father's Supreme Court case, when Mr. Besick really, you know, was taking this on, he was threatened to be ostracized from the Northern California affiliate of the ACLU. And in 2001, the national ACLU gave my father and Gordon Hirabayashi the Roger Baldwin Award. And Roger Baldwin was the executive director of the national ACLU.
The Earl Warren Award as well.
Right. Yeah, and yes, and then also my father received the Earl Warren Award. So the irony is there, but also, you know, we at least try to bring justice to the focus at the end of the day, even though we have a lot of work still to do.
There's a question here.
This is not really a question. It's more of an observation. Looking around the room, it's very exciting and invigorating to see that it's not all Japanese Americans or Asian Americans, because this story and the significance of the incarceration of Japanese Americans must be felt by all Americans. The Japanese American community is shrinking as we speak. And it's no accident that the litigators were not the Nisei generation. This goes to the comment about how you react to crisis. It was the third generation who had the language of civil rights and the righteous indignation who grew up in the United States as citizens, confidently as citizens, who could take on that litigation. And I worry, as a third-generation Japanese-American, about the resonance of JA, internment and incarceration, on Yonsei, Gosei, as our Japanese-Americans go further removed from that experience. And for those of us who pulled these stories out of our parents or our grandparents, that personal shock outrage that we felt, I worry that gets diluted. And our current young folks are not feeling so mm-hmm. much that outrage. But then I look around at our young folks and I see Black Lives Matter and we see other social justice issues. And what we've got to really take from this, it goes to your comment, Lori, about making this significant and keeping this alive, is that people like you write books, is that we continue to teach this in the curriculum so that the Korematsu Institute has a curriculum project. We have to keep these alive in all of our communities. And I would just echo your call to everyone in this room to take it on personally to do something about this, because these issues are certainly not dead and not forgotten.
I agree. I have this really amazing Yonsei nephew in L.A. who's a little Tokyo activist, and I look at kids like that, and I'm just so excited to see what they're doing, number one. Number two, most of the talks I think that we've been giving recently have been talks not with all Japanese Americans on the panel, but talks where there's Muslim representatives of the Muslim community, the Mexican-American community, the Latino community, Black Lives Matter, that what we're seeing wonderfully is really the sense of coalition and the sense of commonality. And so people are really looking at the Japanese-American incarceration as part of that story. And so I think we need to have more of that. So even as you say, the Japanese American community itself is dwindling, the more that our allies can know that we see our story as something on a long continuum, maybe that will help keep it alive as well.
It seems that the most important principle for me, and why I really wanted to have this program as well, is that, you know, we have these American principles that we put in place with our Constitution and so on and so forth. And, of course, we don't always live up to them. But they're there for the time when you're in trouble. They're there for when things go wrong. They're not there for when everything is going right. And so if every time things go wrong, we violate our things, like we have this strict rule against torture, and as soon as we're scared, we go right back to torture, that kind of thing. It's useful that you at least have the principles there, because then afterwards you feel bad about it, maybe. But you ought to live it at the time that the crisis is there, and that's why we kind of keep reminding everybody about all the times where we failed to do that when we felt fear. It is amazing, as it's happened so many times, as soon as the president declares war, 80% of the people are in favor of it. They don't even know what it's about yet. You know? And it's really an unfortunate thing. We have to get a little bit smarter than that. But we're working on it. 200 years in, it's an experiment. So it's time for one last question. You have a question? Great.
There are a bunch of different things that affect Japanese Americans. My two closest Japanese American friends grew up in Tokyo during World War II and were bombed. So it comes down to a question of when is war justifiable, what kind of war is justifiable, and what kind of hate is justifiable. And I don't know that if that builds on this, or is it just an entirely different story?
I think it's the when I was talking about questions to keep asking ourselves, I think the big question is, who are we and who do we want to be as a people? And that applies to domestically, internationally, and can we, you know, so what happened in Japan? Is that something that's human? I don't know. You know, we need to have good leaders. We need to have leaders that we trust to make decisions not about what's legally possible, but what's human and the right thing to do as a people, I guess. And maybe that's totally Pollyanna, you know, but...
Well, we've made progress.
Yeah.
It's about misunderstanding. I mean, there's such a long history before World War II of what was going on between the two countries and the trade and all those different issues that led up to it. So everybody, you said, how can you get people to not hate? It, you know, that we don't really know, but at least if we try to talk to each other and try to understand, that'll at least make it, should make it less. We don't know. If our gut reaction all the time when something bad happens is to be afraid and therefore angry and hate, that is the way we do things. But we can talk ourselves out of that, but we have to be, I think, a little patient because it's not going to happen overnight. So thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
That was excellent.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.